Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a November 9, 2008 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight we have a very special guest, namely Joel Garbin, who is co-author of a new book entitled Breakthrough Power: How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. He's also president of the New Energy Movement. Joel, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, James. Thank you
welcome
for having me on.
No problem. It's our privilege and very happy to have you. So tell us about this new book that you and Gene Manning have authored, Breakthrough Power: How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World.
Well, James, Gene Manning and I have been colleagues since about 2003. Gene, some of your listeners may know, is the author of a book that was launched in 1996 called The Coming Energy Revolution, in which Gene had portrayed a lot of the behind-the-scenes activities going on in the new energy field, specifically with technologies that were working with unconventional principles for energy generation. And over the years, Gene was continuing to follow this new energy scene and felt that now, 12 years later, the time was ripe to have a sequel to The Coming Energy Revolution. She and I had met a few years back when we both were invited by Dr. Brian O'Leary to be founding members of a new nonprofit called the New Energy Movement. And Gene and I both served on the original board of directors of New Energy Movement. From that time, after Brian O'Leary had stepped aside as the head of the organization and asked me to take it over as its president, Gene and I have continued to stay in close contact and collaborate on ideas for how to get the message out to the public in a bigger and better way. The mission of New Energy Movement is to educate the public and policymakers and the investment community on the need for serious and urgent support of breakthrough energy technologies. Well, the book that Gene already had been working on as a sequel was a strong concept in her mind, and she had lots of ideas and excerpts from interviews that she's done with dozens of various researchers. I was able to augment that with a lot of my own experiences and interplay with various inventors. And so we collaborated starting last December on launching this new book, Breakthrough Power. And your listeners can check it out and even can read the first couple chapters of the book online just by going to breakthroughpower.net.
Yes, now fortunately I received an advanced copy, arrived in the mail night before last.
Oh, good. I'm glad you... Yeah.
Yeah, I've had a very busy 48 hours since then, and so I haven't been able to read it entirely. But what I have read is very interesting, encouraging. It really is an excellent book.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think you will note as you read through it that what we are trying to do is make an appeal to the regular mainstream public. This book is not written specifically for a technology steeped audience. This is just for regular folks who don't necessarily have a background in science or physics or anything like that. We portray a lot of the stories of the inventors themselves, both those from past times, such as Nikola Tesla and John Keeley and a few others, but also put a strong focus on the present day inventors who are working on these emerging technologies. And we tell some of their stories. We also lace the book heavily with the implications of their work, both if we continue to have our society ignore what's going on in the new energy soon and the very positive implications if we embrace this and really help to move it forward with a strong public outcry to usher in a new energy revolution.
Well, it's an excellent idea. Someone has to do it. It might as well be you, huh?
Well, we know that we are, Gene and I are definitely aligned with doing this, but we're just two small fish in a big sea that needs to generate what we call a tidal wave of wisdom to help bring the awareness into play of what's going on with all these remarkable technological developments. And so, you know, we look at our role mostly as educational. And so we ask everywhere that we go, wherever we speak, any citizens that we interact with, we always encourage them to you know, stand up and join us and play a part in this. And it's so important for people to share the information. And again, you don't have to be a technologist to take a strong interest in this and have a powerful role to play. I mean, the most important thing is to be able to connect with your own spheres of relationship, whether it's family or friends or business colleagues, and help to create this critical mass of awareness of what the possibilities are, and then start to implement some of the ideas and solutions for actually getting some of these things put into play. And one of the big ways to do that is to make the appeal to our legislators and to government leaders to become aware of these very real technological breakthroughs that simply are starving for lack of funding and attention. Certainly, there's a lot of attention that's being paid to the conventional renewables of wind and solar and biofuels, geothermal, wave power. These we would call the conventional renewables, but there's a tremendous opportunity to marshal along some of these real breakthrough developments that could generate power around the clock, and perhaps in a very elegant and decentralized way that totally changes the whole playing field and can become the basis for a whole new energy economy.
Yeah, but isn't that word decentralized quite abhorrent to the people who are making the most money of any other business in the world, which happens to be centralized power?
Well, you're right. You're right. I think it is very threatening to those who are vested in the current energy infrastructure. And I think that this is something, James, that we need to address from a different avenue. And that is an appeal to the consciousness that's behind this whole way for change. We've seen it in the political spectrum here lately in the U.S. elections. Clearly, people have decisively, called for something different. And I think there's a very palpable hope and anticipation with the change in leadership in Washington against the backdrop of some very dismaying economic and geopolitical factors. But yet people have a tremendous sense of hope. And we share that. We embrace that. I mean, we're not a political organization by any means. And I myself, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. But what we are for is vision and wisdom. And by people coming together and first making the decision personally about, what are we really here for? Are we here on this planet just to kind of, go about our way, just being a consumer, trying to just have a nice life and maybe carving out a little niche of some sort? Or are we here for something grander? Are we here to maybe dream up something together that transcends any prior possibilities that we might have considered? I mean, isn't it possible that we might actually be here to heal a planet that's in serious need of help? And I would suggest that, yes, that is why we're here. We're here to...
I'm sorry.
Excuse me?
Yeah, well, in the case of most people, you wouldn't expect them to abandon the first position to take up the second, but you would hope that they would embrace both, being consumers who are also somewhat concerned about their surroundings. And
oh, well, we're definitely not asking people to give up something. What we're asking them to do is to embrace the possibilities of something so much better than the way we're currently going about our planet. And I guess in trying to address your original question about how receptive will people who are invested in the current power structure How will they receive these ideas that we're putting forth for decentralized power and very disruptive technologies? Well, again, it goes back to, what do we want? Do we want a world of scarcity and a world of resource wars, a world of geopolitical tensions, a world where we keep this separation-mindedness so strongly entrenched that we can hardly even empathize with children who live in another land who speak another language? Or do we want something that's a lot more inclusive, that's based on a world of abundance, one that's based on sharing and collaborating for solving the world's problems, which are solvable, but it requires us to go about things in a different way? And to me, that's tremendously hopeful. And we're seeing more and more people who are coming to that consciousness jump. And so much of what we're talking about with the new energy movement and with Breakthrough Power, the new book, is about a concurrent evolution in consciousness and energy technology. They're definitely intertwined, James.
Yeah, and of course, the more painful the energy situation is with regard to the price of it and the obvious damage that current technologies are doing to the planet or to the environment, then people are more inclined to listen to a message like this. Otherwise, they're quite uncaring, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that is the case. It usually takes for there to be a mass awakening. There usually needs to be some jarring event. And I would say for most Americans anyway, that jarring event was this very rapid and steep escalation of fuel prices. So it was hitting every American right in their wallet, which, tends to wake people up in a hurry. So I think people had been able to kind of, put all these, dire warnings and rumblings about peak oil and the whole being hostage to the fossil fuel cartel and all these other dire sayings. When it comes down to people suddenly realizing, God, they got to shell out, $50 to $100 just to fill up their gas tank, suddenly it's like, wow, there really is something going on here. We seem to be really vulnerable to being locked into this fossil fuel empire. So now I think people are very, very ripe to hear a different way of going about this. So we, although Gene and I could not have predicted that this, that the backdrop for the launch of our book would coincide with record oil prices, that's the way it's turned out. It's an interesting synchronicity, and we feel it's no accident.
Yeah, so you have people's attention, or at least you did until about 2 weeks ago, when the price of fuel went down to where it's here in Kentucky, it's down to $1.75 a gallon for gasoline. So
yep.
Unfortunately, people's interest quickly wanes when they get back to a comfortable level of what they're paying.
You're right. It does tend to wane, and I think that's where education needs to come into play in an even stronger way. I mean, people had the shock. They had the visceral reaction to these factors that are seemingly out of the citizens' control, this vast run-up in fuel prices. But now we have to strengthen the foundation of why and where is this going and what are the alternatives and how can we have something that's so much better, so much healthier, something that is in the best interest of our whole civilization and in the generations that succeed us. And that is choosing, consciously choosing, a new direction in energy. And it should not be just the conventional renewables of solar and wind and biofuels that get so much airplay right now, but it needs to also turn over all the stones to uncover a lot of these hidden gems that the public and the mainstream media have not been aware of. And that is these revolutionary breakthroughs that are right on the cusp of delivering something that's just remarkable, almost unthinkable.
Okay, so why don't we spend a few minutes talking about some of those breakthroughs that are included in your book?
Okay, well, one that really has me excited is the breakthrough that was developed by Dr. Randall Mills of Black Light Power, and the discovery that Dr. Mills made, who has very strong credentials. He's a medical doctor. He's an electrical engineer. He's very, very highly regarded as far as his academic rigor in investigation and research. Well, what he had discovered is that by taking hydrogen gas and heating it up in the presence of a very common metal, that this metal can act as a catalyst to do something absolutely startling and that was considered impossible from quantum physics. And what it is this. When that hydrogen gas is heated up in the presence of this metal, the atom itself, the hydrogen atom itself, actually shrinks. The diameter of the atom actually collapses to a smaller diameter. And what's happening there is the electron of that atom is collapsing to a lower energy level, which I'm not going to go into all the chemistry of this, but that was considered impossible from the theories of quantum mechanics. But Dr. Mills has been able to show repeatedly, and the process has been verified with third-party university testing, that by using his process, there is a great excess of energy output compared to the energy input to initiate the reaction. And so whenever we have a technology that makes this claim where there's excess energy output versus input, generally it's considered an over-unity device. And all that means is that somehow there is an input energy that is not being able to be measured by current human means. Our instrumentation is not sophisticated enough yet to detect what the input energy is, but yet our conventional means are able to readily measure the output. In this case, the output from the Mills invention is heat. There's a tremendous amount of excess heat that comes off of this process, and it's much more than the amount of energy that's required to go into the process to heat up the hydrogen gas originally. The other thing that makes this technology so compelling is that this new type of material, this hydrogen atom that is now in a lower energy state, actually has new material properties as well. And so there are novel compounds that can be manufactured out of this new material. And one of the things from the energy standpoint that has tremendous implications is the Blacklight Power Company, who has now received a lot of independent funding in the order of tens of millions of dollars and the endorsement of a very, very highly credentialed staff of scientists and others, including a backing by some utility companies. They have announced that they are going to be launching this technology in 2009, first as a 50-kilowatt reactor, but then something that will be scalable up to power plant scale. So ultimately, the goal here would be able to replace the polluting fossil fuel power plant to generate electricity with this closed-loop, non-polluting process that Dr. Mills has discovered. So that's one technology that we're very excited about, you know, because it has such strong science behind it. It's disruptive from a lot of ways, including the physics and new theories and new implications for quantum mechanics that comes about from this.
Yeah.
So there's one right there.
Okay, just so for a better understanding on the part of the average lay listener, when you said closed loop, we are referring to a system that basically treats water like cold fusion, right?
Well, the Mills process.
Technology,
yeah, yeah. When I'm talking closed loop in this case, is that the fuel for the Mills process actually is water itself. So the process can generate the excess heat that comes from the process, can be used to drive a standard steam turbine generator to produce electricity. That electricity can be used to electrolyze water and then that you know, the hydrogen that comes off of the electrolysis then is screened out and is fed back into the reactor, the solid fuel
reactor. So the
reactor
needs fresh hydrogen.
It does need fresh hydrogen.
Okay.
And so closed loop from that standpoint. And I still have a few questions about the technology itself. You know, one of which is, you know, how does the new type of hydrogen atom, the hydrino, which is the term that Mills has coined for this, how does the hydrino hydrogen end up in the environment? I would think that simple exposure to sunlight would likely restore the energy level of the electron back to the original ground state level and essentially restore it to normal hydrogen. But I haven't seen where that's been discussed yet, but it's a question I have. But
so
the technology...
The technology has
a lot of promise here from the standpoint of the energy delivery.
Okay. Now, pictures of Dr. Mills have shown him holding something that looks like a large stack of 45 RPM records.
Right. Yes.
So
I think that's the 50 kilowatt solid fuel reactor that he's holding.
And isn't that awesome that something so compact
could
be the central core of this technology?
Well, when you think about what he's really doing here, is he's simply heating a gas in the presence of a solid fuel catalyst. There's nothing there that in principle is all that elaborate. It's fairly simple in its design, and I think that elegance is part of the really compelling and promising nature of this. It's not something that is so vastly complex that it takes a team of rocket scientists to put together. I think it sounds like something that could be scaled up very readily, and the inputs to this are very common materials. They're not exotic materials, and I think those type of processes and technologies are the things that we really want. We don't want to have to be using a lot of exotic, expensive materials that are hard to come by, or that are vulnerable to some type of gate closing on the supply chain for the materials that go into making a device.
And yet, that's where they make their money, though, in the utility industry, is by having huge refineries that the average person can't crack their own gasoline. You know, even if they had crude oil on their property that they were able to pump out of the ground, they wouldn't be able to produce their own fuel from it.
Well, you're right, and they're certainly, you know, the Mills device makes no guarantee that it's suddenly going to cause, decentralization of electrical power generation, because, you know, clearly one of their main targets is to go in to the existing power plants and replace fossil fuel with their technology. Now that definitely has positive implications from the standpoint of pollution and the greenhouse gas issue, but it doesn't really take care of the issue of the grid vulnerability, nor the kind of the heavy-handed control that the big energy infrastructure companies, whether they're oil or utility grids or whatever, that they have over the consumer right now.
Namely, price.
But excuse me.
Namely, the price of the energy that they're offering.
Right. Because the consumer has very, very few other options right now in most cases.
There's not enough competition, for instance, for the natural gas industry, which is telling us that this winter people's heat bill is going to go up, I think, 17%.
It's
already escalated tremendously.
Well, exactly. I mean, the fossil fuel picture is a cartel. I mean, it's very clear it's a cartel, and the prices are manipulated. And, you know, I think people are waking up to that being the case. You said that gas is $1.75 where you are in Kentucky. Well, out here in Portland, Oregon, I'm still seeing, $2.30, $2.40 a gallon. Well, why the heck is that? How can it be 70 cents a gallon difference across the country?
Well, I've seen it 10 cents difference across the street. Here yesterday it was. Which is sort of funny, you know, that much disparity between stations that normally compete.
Right, right. So that's one of the technologies of promise. I think we're seeing some other things too here. There's a neat new small scale solar device that was invented by a company called Infinia, who's based in Western Washington State. And Infinia's technology essentially is a concentrated solar power device. It has a parabolic dish on it that focuses those solar rays on a Stirling engine, which essentially is a canister filled with an expandable gas, in this case helium. And then as that gas expands and contracts, it drives a piston, which provides the mechanical motion to run a generator. And these new Infinia Stirling engines are quite small scale, so they'll deliver about 3 kilowatts per unit, which is enough to run the average home. And I met with the CEO of that company, a man named J.D. Simmons, a few months back, and had a chance to talk to him a bit about his technology. And it's great. I mean, it's neat to see new things like this coming out. And one of the great things about his technology also is they've used some variants of their technology in applications for NASA in satellites for solar power. And they've had a lot of rigorous testing over the years. So their parts are quite robust, and they won't be wearing out quickly. So that's a technology of promise as well.
Okay, and these things are all considered in your book.
Right. Yep. These are things that are real. These aren't fantasy land or the Jetsons, year 2300. One of the places where people also can go to check out a lot of these technologies is they can go to a sister organization to the New Energy Movement, and this one is called New Energy Congress. And just by going to newenergycongress.org and clicking on the top 100, folks can check out this continuously updated and publicly viewable database of all these new energy technologies. And the gentleman who runs and organizes New Energy Congress, his name is Sterling Allen, he's done a tireless job in putting a vast amount of information up on this website so people can stay abreast of what's going on. And the field is moving so fast, James. It's hard to keep up with all the new developments. So what we're trying to do here, with the Breakthrough Power book, is just to give the readers a sampling of some of these promising new solutions that are out there, and to whet the public's appetite for coming to a greater understanding of what these possibilities are, and to become fully aware that we do not have to be satisfied with the status quo. We don't have to be saddled with polluted skies, polluted water, with a landscape that's crisscrossed with power lines everywhere that are a blight to the eye. We can go in a whole new direction of clean, decentralized power that diffuses the geopolitical tensions, that makes oil wars obsolete, and that promises a whole new era of cooperation, environmental stewardship, and healthier living for our families and the generations to come. And it's exciting.
Yeah, and you also address the economic ramifications, because there is a lot of fear. People are insecure about rocking the boat, especially with it already being in such a rocked condition at this time.
Right.
So
right.
I noticed that you do address the fact that people's paranoia of what new energy technology can, the effect that it could have on the world's economy.
We are not naive to the fact that there will be dislocation that comes with a new energy revolution. Just like how, buggy manufacturers who were everywhere went out of business when the automobile came along, and just like the office typists that were employed in every business no longer were needed when the word processing programs came along with the personal computer, Well, there will be dislocation of folks who work in the fossil fuel and nuclear energies as well. Now, that can produce a gut-level, visceral fear for people who feel threatened by that. And I totally, totally understand that. I know what it's like to be dislocated, from an industry. I've gone through that myself. But the promise here is that if we are wise about our policies, as far as our economic and government policies, the people who are displaced from these polluting industries can be trained and redeployed in a whole new economy that's based on clean and green energy. And it's no accident that all the candidates for office lately, especially, our recent presidential candidates, they were talking about green-collar jobs. They're talking about a whole new economy based on clean, green energy. Because you know what? That makes sense. It is the right way to go. It's a vision that is necessary for our future. And I'm not trying to downplay the fact that it's painful to watch jobs disappear in these entrenched industries. I'm very compassionate toward that. However, we also have to look at what's in the best interest of our nation and our planet and make those choices that bear in mind the consequences for our children and our grandchildren. And we will be better off for doing that. But it does take some courage to do it. And it also takes some education and a willingness to step out of the fear. And those are difficult things to do, James, and I know that. But I would rather that our public be prepared, get the information, understand what the possibilities are, and then make the choices and the decisions that align us with what's going to be in the best interest of our planet.
So the question is, how big of an if is it when we say if people will wise up, and if they will choose the intelligent path? I mean, are we really expecting too much out of a society that behaves as ours does?
No, I don't think it is a stretch. And we just saw a recent example of that in the 2008 presidential election. What were the odds of the outcome that occurred? Those odds were very long, even a year ago, and the whole world has seen what has happened with the presidential elections here, and I believe have rejoiced in the most part that the United States has reasserted leadership, and the U.S. public has taken charge of its destiny and its legacy, realized that. That our country was acting like a pariah on this planet, and being treated as a pariah, and now we're saying, hey, we need a change of direction, and we're going to band together as citizens and make a decisive change of direction, and that is what happened. So I have great confidence in the common people. There will be some dissension. There will be, take a while for there to be that critical mass that I described earlier to create the tidal wave of wisdom to do what's in the best interest of a nation and a planet. But it will happen because, consciousness evolves. It doesn't want to be retrograde. It wants to continue to spiral upward to newer and better and grander. It does not want to de-evolve to something that is worse and polluted and enslaved. So I have great confidence that the American public and the global public will eventually make the wise decisions here and will take the power out of the hands of the select few who are on top of the energy pyramid right now and who will reassert leadership from the public itself. The fact that our public has stepped away from apathy and indifference and got so heavily involved in this last election, to me, just serves as a template for what can happen in the whole energy scene as well.
Right. And would you not agree that it does have to be something cheap and something easy for the average person, the common person, to latch on to a new technology that they would actually be implementing in their own house or in their own vehicle.
Oh, I think that's definitely preferred and will make the transition much more popular and easier to support. You know, in interviewing so many of these different inventors and knowing a lot of them personally and hearing their stories, I know both Gene Manning and I can say that there is a common vision among so many of them, and that is a technology that results in a small appliance, it might be the size of a laptop computer, that is a solid-state device, has no moving parts. It generates all the electrical power requirements for the average home. It simply interfaces with the circuit breaker in a house to provide the power that's required. And then there'd be a similar device that could be used in an electric vehicle to be the power plant for those vehicles. And there is no doubt that our vehicle fleets on this planet are headed toward an all-electric fleet. What we see with the hybrid vehicles right now simply are a transition stage where they're half internal combustion, half electric. GM with their the Chevy Volt, that's going to be that much closer to an all-electric vehicle, although it will still have some internal combustion on board. And then the plug-in hybrids as well. They're all steps toward an all-electric fleet. Well, having a device such as I just described, where you actually have the power generation in this small device, will definitely make an all-electric fleet come to fruition. And these are things that within I think we're going to be able to look back in 10 or 20 years and say, holy cow, our kids are going to be saying, you mean you, what are those things there in the distance? What are those big tall things reaching up to the sky, those big cylinders made of brick? And the mother or father's going to say, well, those are smokestacks. And the reply will be, well, mommy, daddy, what's a smokestack? and they're going to hear the story, and the kids are going to go, you did what? You burned this black gunk that you took out of the ground, and it made the sky black and polluted the air and the water with mercury, until all the fish on the planet and all the children that were born had a poisonous toxin in their bodies, and you continued to do that for over a century? Yeah, come on, Mom. You're pulling my leg.
Well,
you know what
I
mean?
The scenario that you presented in your book, that an extraterrestrial civilization would be making such comments about the inhabitants of this planet, that they were so lame that they behaved like this, and then excused it by saying, well, if we try anything different, the whole thing will collapse.
Right. Right. Well, I love that analogy as well, because I think it really puts it on the head of what are short-sighted decisions and what are visionary decisions. The short-sighted one is to stick with the status quo because it doesn't seemingly require much work. It doesn't require much effort. It doesn't require much courage. Well, that's all well and good, but it ends up in an early grave for so much of our own civilization and our companion species. Taking the more difficult path of being willing to embrace change, being willing to hold a vision in mind and then collectively working toward that does require effort. But what pans out as the result is so worth that investment, because it will result in a world we can scarcely imagine right now. I mean, I have two daughters and a one-year-old granddaughter, and I am continuously motivated in what I do as an act of service with them in mind, as far as what kind of world am I bequeathing to these young ones. And I keep thinking about how great it's going to be for them to be able to, walk along a roadside. The traffic that's going by will be virtually silent. There'll be no polluting toxins coming out of tailpipes. There won't even be tailpipes. That they'll see that there's actually fruit trees and berry bushes and vegetables actually can be grown in the median strips of the roads and along the sidewalks. No longer will that soil be contaminated, with this toxic exhaust from our vehicles. They'll be able to walk along the Columbia River. Perhaps no longer will the Columbia drainage be dammed up like it has been for so many decades. And the salmon will have returned so thick that you could walk across their backs across the river the way the Indians used to describe them. I mean, these are just a few small snippets of the vision that I see, and those are just kind of local things, and it doesn't even consider the incredible possibility for the world culture where there's cooperation in solving the great problems that have vexed us, whether it's poverty and starvation. Whether it's the large epidemics that have devastated significant portions of the population, other things as well. And what about space travel? I mean, the new energy technologies will allow a whole new era of space exploration. And to me, that's incredibly exciting. You know, I no longer would have to think, well, gosh, maybe some, future generation. Well, maybe, James, even in our generation, we'd be able to be one of those who is able to take a ride to the moon or to Mars or whatever. That possibility just to me is very stimulating.
And yet I'd be content just to be part of the scenario that you described where there's no pollution coming out of the tailpipes.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need to go to another planet. I'd be happy just to see this one improved. You know, I think there's plenty to enjoy here without having to even think about going somewhere else. But on the other hand, if we destroy this place, then what else is there but having to even go somewhere else?
Right. What else is there? And what would an extraterrestrial visitor have to say? You know, what lessons would they be able to impart? Would they have visited because they had destroyed their own world because they didn't learn the lesson in time? Would they want to tell us their story in hopes that we learn before we made the same mistake, or would they just be kind of observing and seeing what's been the progress of evolution of this human species that has so much promise to do incredible, remarkable things if they could just put their separation-mindedness and their warring tendencies aside, if they could just learn to cooperate and share the same things they teach their youngest children, yet somehow do not embrace at the leadership level and at the government level. You know, it must that's such an ambivalence that becomes very stark.
Absolutely. Well, there are many of us whose religious viewpoint or philosophy does not allow for humans to eventually solve all these problems because these are the things that we pray, like when we say, "Thy kingdom come." We're asking for a divine being to actually save us from ourselves. Now, I've been trying to harmonize, well, how does that viewpoint of Christianity or even other religions, how does it harmonize with a person promoting a human solution such as clean energy technology in the interim?
Well, this is a good.
Even if a person doesn't embrace the hope that you've expressed that mankind is going to pick itself up by the bootstraps and solve these problems, how can a person who embraces a different philosophy about what the future holds still be part of the promoting of something radically different in the energy systems that we use now?
Well, this is an excellent question, and these are the types of questions that I love to talk about in more detail, and I know can't be done justice with a small interview or short interview like this. But here's something to consider. From the standpoint of a creator and the relationship of that creator to its creation, all right, would not that creator want the creation to have wise stewardship of the home where the created is placed. Would not God want mankind to be a good steward of the garden?
Absolutely.
Rather than to be devastating the garden such that it fosters tension and impulses of greed and selfishness. You mentioned, Christianity. Jesus himself, I mean, what does he say? He says, well, love thy enemy as thyself. You know, forgive thy neighbor. How are those very fundamental yet profound teachings, how is that reflected in our national policy where we are going to war over scarce resources, where probably the most stable single industry in the United States right now is the military-industrial complex for weapons of destruction? How is that any way in line with what Jesus asks us to do? You see, I don't see how that can be compromised without a true loss of integrity and a real distortion of that very simple message. So I think that embracing technologies consciously that will help us to do a better job of being caretakers of the garden, such that it improves the cooperation and the ability for us to love our neighbor who may be in another country, who may even call the Creator by a different name. Those are all things that become much more possible than the way we are polarized right now. I don't think that Jesus or any other of the master teachers from any religion, you name them, I don't think they would be very pleased or proud with the way folks have conducted themselves, supposedly, in their name.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think there's a better way.
And, you know, the news reports from the past couple of years show that mainstream religion has been preaching a new gospel of green, consciousness.
Yes, yes.
It has become popular.
Yes, and I think that is part of this evolution of consciousness. You know, in my own study, and I've had many, many years studying religions and religious philosophy and spiritual philosophy, and I think it's totally consistent and resonant with the desire to serve in the capacity of bringing about a new energy revolution. And what I see is that the way this movement has been in fundamental circles to embrace a stewardship of the planet through environmental awareness and green technology, or however you might want to phrase it, I see that is a higher order understanding of a spiritual philosophy that was implanted thousands of years ago. And so there is evolution that occurs in the average human understanding of these spiritual philosophies, that have been given to us a long time ago. And I think that those central tenets of sharing and cooperation and forgiveness, those things are so simple, but yet they're profound, and they get forgotten in a world that conditions its citizens with images of greed and selfishness and fear, continual bombardment of fear, most especially. It's not difficult to see how we get bogged down and we miss the message here. I mean, I would ask you to consider this. What would our world would have looked like today if after 9/11, if the President of the United States had even said to the people of the U.S., we have two choices. We can choose to use all of the high-tech weaponry at our disposal to go and exact, vengeance on those who have done this, or we could choose to forgive. And you know what, James? I believe that even offering that as an option to the folks of this country would have shifted everything. Even if the public had still insisted for blood, I think that even having a leader to present that even as an option, something besides just more violence and war, it would have been such a huge leap in consciousness that it would have changed everything. And I think those are the types of leadership behaviors that I believe the public of this country have been calling out for in the change that's just occurred. I do believe there's evolution occurring in our consciousness here, and it's a positive thing. And I'm not trying to speak of evolution in the way that gets people all mucked up with their controversies.
Right, you're talking about a change in consciousness.
I'm talking about a change of consciousness, being responsible, being personally responsible for the thoughts that we choose to embrace, because our thoughts are the most powerful thing that we have at our disposal. And when we give them away to other people to choose for us, you can't be surprised when you become enslaved by decisions someone else makes. If we choose to be responsible ourselves, well, now we really have the ability to be of great service and high impact for the good on a planetary scale.
Okay, and I will say that there are some promising events that have taken place this past summer and even the day after tomorrow. That'll be Tuesday, the 11th of November. There's going to be an event in Florida, Palmetto, Florida, called the HHO Games and Exposition, being sponsored by a journalist down there, Joe Shea. And this is a bringing together of mostly hydrogen booster devices from all over the country and even out of the country. I think there will be numerous devices on display that can be installed under the hood of a vehicle to save fuel and reduce tailpipe emissions.
That should be a fun event. Are you planning to attend that?
Yeah, I'm going to be heading down there tomorrow. And
oh, good.
I
wish I could be there, but I can't make that one. But it sounds like a really great gathering. You know, even in our book Breakthrough Power, I don't know if you've gotten to this section yet, but you know, we do have a section that's devoted to water as fuel technologies, and we highlight the stories of some of the pioneers in that field, and it makes for fun reading. But one of the points that we put in there is, you know, anyone can go type in water as fuel on the internet, and they can watch hours and hours of video, you know, that have been produced by folks who are inventing all across the planet. It's not just
exactly.
Here in the U.S. or Canada.
Yeah,
and
that's what this event
everywhere.
Is coming together of many of those people. And again, as you just mentioned, and in fact, even in your book, you emphasize, I'll just lift a phrase from it. As I'm looking for it, though, I'll mention what I was going to say, that there will probably be YouTube video of this event that you'll be able to see. So even though you can't attend, you'll be able to catch up on what took place, I'm sure, through numerous YouTube postings. But in your book, you use an expression, you say on page, I guess this is page 10 of the introduction, of the preface, you use the expression, the result of that global brain trust is an international effort to completely change the sources of energy on which our world is based. So you use the word, the phrase, global brain trust, here
yes.
And in other places in the book.
Yes.
Yeah, up above, I'm sorry, here it is. Yeah, just above it says, the Internet allows the global brain trust of inventors, engineers, other researchers, and activists to make connections at a previously impossible speed. So would you like to comment on that?
Sure.
Concept?
I think that when we study this whole phenomena of this new energy movement in the larger sense, many of us feel intuitively that a new energy revolution could not come about without the advent of the Internet, because it's been such a tool of freedom of information sharing at such a rate, such a pace, such a volume that was unprecedented, you know, just a few years ago. And so now we have the ability for people, millions of people around the world who had no knowledge of any of these things, suddenly get passed a link by a friend, and they suddenly become aware that, oh my gosh, there's this a whole new realm of development going on out there. And they see the promise. They see the excitement. They hear it in the voices, the enthusiasm in those who are speaking on the videos about, wow, something cool is happening here. And it's something that becomes a shared and collective experience very quickly. And so that global brain trust is the collective efforts. It's the collective intent. It's the ingenuity and creativity of all of these global thousands and thousands of inventors of various stripes, and who also are using the internet to benefit the world from the information that they can convey at lightning speed. So we feel it's a very very powerful tool for this movement and for us finally to break through the inertia that's held these incredible technologies at bay.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the powers that be, if they could have anticipated this global brain trust, you know, connecting on the internet, do you think that they would have steered the development of the internet differently? Do you think they would have prevented this from happening if they could have, if they could have anticipated that it was going to happen?
That's a wonderful question, and it would be easy to say yes, they would have desired the internet to be limited in many ways, because then the ability to maintain the control paradigm in place would have been better facilitated. But you know what? My gut tells me that had it not been the internet, it would have been something else that would have permitted this transmission of ideas at a rapid pace. Hard to know what that might have looked like, but you know what? You can't hold back a flood of great ideas when those ideas are being shared, and
it was going to be born one way or another. In other words,
right? And I don't know who said it, but you know, nothing can hold back a great idea whose time has come.
Yeah, right.
And that's what I see. Whether it had manifested as the internet or telepathy to a high degree, or who knows what, but it was going to happen. And you know, this is the result of the conscious evolution on the scale of a planet. It's not just because of a few inventors who want to share a great idea. But let's not dismiss or marginalize the fact that the sharing of ideas is tremendously powerful, because ideas are strengthened as they're shared, and that taps directly into the power of our own minds and thoughts, because you know, our thoughts precede everything that we do, and so when we align those things with strong intention and coherence, and we share them, incredible things happen and can happen very quickly. So this new energy revolution is going to happen. Is it going to take longer than some would like? Well, I think, you know, Jean Manning, my co-author, when she wrote The Coming Energy Revolution in 1996, certainly she thought by now that we would have that little laptop energy converter that would be powering everyone's house. She thought that already would be on the market by now. So, but there's been a lot of opposition. There's been a lot of understandable vested interest, oppression of this information getting out. Certainly both Gene and I have met a number of inventors who've told us their own personal stories of suppression that's manifested in various forms.
Right, and those stories are entertaining. I mean, we don't want to, subscribe to every conspiracy theory out there, but reading your book, just having read through some of it, it is very fascinating to read these stories, and including, I just want to mention one, because the average person like myself is probably totally unaware of this, but John F. Kennedy was involved in promoting a particular alternative energy technology just before he was assassinated. I thought
yeah.
that was fascinating.
Yes, exactly. It's a story that most people have never heard. You know what? I had never heard of that till Gene made me aware of it. This book is full of stories like this. There's gems and nuggets of wisdom and experience and personal anecdote in here that I think can touch people in various ways. And we have. You know, Gene and I have been touched by some of these, some of these suppression issues and tactics. I'm not saying that anyone has ever tried to keep me from delivering the message of the New Energy Movement, because that hasn't been the case. But I certainly have seen the pain and distress on the faces and in the voices of inventors and their families as they've described what has happened to them, and sometimes in a very heavy-handed and violent ways. But neither Gene nor I are interested in becoming fixated on that and diving into all the fear that can surround those things. What we want to do is deliver a message of hope. In fact, I would even suggest reaching out to those who were so afraid that they felt that they needed to impose their will on someone else to restrict their freedom. We would reach out to those and say, look, join us. Join what we are doing. You know, come and realize that this is in the best interest of everyone, yourselves included, and join us. And I think, there have been those who have been oppressors before who when they become, I'll use the word converted, they become the greatest champions. And I think you could look at, you mentioned in the Christian tradition, St. Paul certainly would be a great example of that.
As an opposer who converted. Huh?
Right. Because I've heard, when I've told some of my colleagues at times, I said, I would welcome having lunch with, personality A, B, and C, whoever is the supposed demon of the day, who are in the secrecy culture, or who are the oppressors, whether they're, within our own government or outside. You can probably, you would recognize some of those names right away. But, what they say, what do you mean you'd want to have lunch with them? I mean, we should be calling for these guys to be strung up and shot. And I said, no. That's exactly opposite of what needs to happen here. One, that's exactly opposite the message of those who were the most enlightened on this planet and who tried to teach us even thousands of years ago, Jesus included. He would not have approved of that approach. I said, but the other thing is here is all of us know what it's like to have such a vested interest at heart and such a fear of anything that seems to threaten our vested interest that we have imposed our will on somebody else. I know I've done it at times in my life. I'm not proud of it.
Honest about our protective instincts.
Exactly. And those are very understandable. Everybody has these impulses. And I'm not discounting that at all or condemning anyone for having them. I have them myself, continue to have them. But I know what I'm willing to do now is at least recognize when my mind is tending in that direction. And it gives me the opportunity to stop and look at it and to choose, is this the way I want to be? Is this why I'm here on this planet? Is it to be filled with fear? Is it to polarize myself from others? Is it to just wall myself off from people who may have a different viewpoint or a different race or religion or language? Is that the highest that I'm capable of? Well, of course not. We are all capable of something much, much higher and grander than that. And I simply choose to now be of service in a way where my career and my training and education and all that has put me in a position to perhaps be able to lend a little bit of leverage toward educating on the topic, and there that is. you know, but everybody's got their
role. Service that you're rendering, I must add. You know, we've never been acquainted before. We just talked briefly on the phone the other day, but it's obvious that you are a person who has done more than your share of selfless, you know, sacrifice for the education of the public at large. And that's really
well. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, but I also would suggest this. It has not been selfless sacrifice, because this is in my interest and in the interest of my family, my grandchildren, and the generations to come. So I have a personal stake in this. It's simply that I can see that we all have the capacity to want to be of service to people who we may never meet. We all have that. You know, we are all in this together. We're all stakeholders on this little planet that I think is crying out for some healing, James. And
yeah,
I don't look at that as a sacrifice at all. I mean, what should I be doing? Is it a sacrifice to turn off watching American Idol or playing online poker or hanging out in some bar or whatever? Is it a sacrifice to forego those things and maybe instead, you know, make a call to somebody or stop and talk to a stranger, to sit down and listen to somebody who's having a problem or is challenged, you know, with some issue, you know, or just wanting to just connect, or even to stop and pray for a better world. You know, that none of that is a sacrifice in my mind. To me, these are the things that we choose to do when we want a healthier, happier, more beautiful world. And it is ours to choose. And I believe this goes back to your earlier question about, you know, the Creator. You know, what would God want us to be doing? And I think that trying to align ourselves with the idea of heaven wherever we go. And right now we find ourselves on a planet, all right? And we find ourselves with physical bodies, you know, society, very real physical problems. You know, how can we best model a heavenly ideal while we are here and finding ourselves in these material circumstances? We can choose hell while we're here, or we can choose something that's transcendent. And I think the call is for us to choose the latter.
Yeah, well, apparently enough hell has been chosen already.
Yeah.
So it's been very nice. Our half hour has turned into just over an hour, so it's been good sharing this information, and it would be nice to do a follow-up interview after continuing unfolding of events.
That would very rapidly. Yeah, that'd be wonderful, and perhaps the next time Gene Manning could join in on this. And I encourage everyone to please take a look at our book. You can go online to breakthroughpower.net. Check it out. You can read some excerpts from the book. If you see something that you like there, please share the information with people. That's what it's there for. You also can check out our organization, New Energy Movement, at newenergymovement.org. and see what we're trying to do there in way of reaching out to the public and policymakers as well.
Yeah, and I would even encourage people to get more than one copy of your book for distribution. And I understand that if someone is interested in acquiring a large quantity of books to share them with others, that is possible.
Yeah, and there are discounts available for those case prices, and you can see that information there. You know, Christmas is coming up. I know people are always looking for some type of novel gift that has some meaning to it. And I think folks will find that this book not only is a very compelling read, but it's educational and it's impactful. And I can tell you, no one will regret having received this as a gift. So, I hope your listeners consider that opportunity as well.
Yeah, and I would add that it's also very interesting. There's some very, very interesting storytelling in the book.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we say goodnight then and hope that we'll have more to talk about in the very near future.
Thank you, James. It's been a privilege being on your program.
And it's been a privilege having you. And good night to everyone. Bye-bye.